Welcome to Iowa Public Radio's Iowa Art Showcase, our monthly performing arts program devoted to Iowa's not-for-profit arts and cultural organizations. Thanks for joining us. I'm Jacqueline Hallblum. For June and July, we'll hear about a creative writing and literature conference hosted by UNI and the Hearst Center for the Arts, celebrating the bicentennial of the North American Review. We'll speak with the founder and artistic director of ISU's Heartland Marimba Festival. We'll catch up with two members of the Bellin Quartet who perform free every Friday during the summer in downtown Des Moines. We'll discover what gems the nationally recognized Des Moines Metro Opera has scheduled for their summer season. And we'll see how one city put their hearts and souls into saving an international treasure for everyone to enjoy. That's all ahead on Iowa Public Radio's Iowa Art Showcase.
I came to Mason City in January of 1967, after I married John in December of 66, and it was minus 22. And John said, "Annie, I'm going to take you on a little tour of the city." Well, I knew immediately when I saw that building that it was something very, very special. We came very, very close to having it demolished. And every time I go by there or think about it, I have to pinch myself that we actually saved this and did the restoration and completed it, and it's a functioning boutique hotel.
It is amazing, and I think all of us that worked so many hours and put our heart and soul into that building are still amazed that we pulled it off. And I think it's given Mason City such pride, and my only wish is that Martha could be here to see it.
2 days before Martha died, she was at Mayo and then transferred down to the hospice inpatient unit. We had received our certificate of occupancy, and before Martha died, I was able to share that with her. So it was a done deal.
It's a special building in a lot of ways.
Ann McGregor, the retired Ride on the Park executive director, along with the current Ride on the Park finance director and former mayor of Mason City, Jean Marinos. The third musketeer of this trio, Ride on the Park project architect Martha Huntington, helped hold the massive project renovations together. Martha passed away in July of 2011, just 2 months prior to the official grand opening of the historic Park Inn. In 2006, Martha had spoken to Iowa Public Radio about why it was so important for Mason City to save the Park Inn Hotel.
It is the last remaining Frank Lloyd Wright Hotel, and one of the few banks that are left standing. It was also a very important building at the time that it was built. It was actually more well-known in Europe because it's a multi-use building, and it was published in a book over there that got a lot of people interested in Frank Lloyd Wright design. It's very well-known in Japan, actually, because the Imperial Hotel was built following the Park Inn Hotel, and the massing of the central part of that building is very similar to the Park Inn. And the building itself was also very influential among some European architects. So from that standpoint, it's a very important building. But for Mason City, it's extremely important because we have the largest collection of Prairie School architecture outside of Oak Park. So it would have been such a huge loss if these buildings had been torn down.
Ride on the Park project architect Martha Huntington, from an interview recorded in July of 2006. Ann and Jean fill us in on the behind-the-scenes background of Mason City's historic Park Inn and its famous architect, Mr. Frank Lloyd Wright.
He was a persona non grata when he went to Europe with Mamie Chaney, so he wouldn't have been very welcome back to Mason City. He was in Mason City during the design phase and the early days of the construction, but he never returned to Mason City. And overseeing the construction was an associate of Mr. Wright's.
What was the reason that he even came to Mason City to build this?
Well, that's interesting because there were two lawyers in Mason City, Blythe and Markley. And Mr. Markley's daughters went to boarding school in Spring Green, Wisconsin, and Mr. Wright designed the school where his maiden aunts taught at that school. And Mr. Markley, when Markley and Blythe needed expanded office space, Markley immediately thought of Frank Lloyd Wright. And so that's how Frank Lloyd Wright came to Mason City, Iowa.
And this project then was sort of a three-pronged project. It wasn't just the bank or just law offices.
Yeah, their law offices were on the top floor of the City National Bank building, and they added a hotel for additional revenue. And in the early 1900s, Mason City was booming and growing in population with the brick and tile yards, the cement plants. So it was really, really booming. And in the early 20s, there was an agricultural crisis and a downturn in the economy, and the City National Bank failed.
And at that particular point, I think when they sold off the bank building and it turned into a retail space, the law offices, I think, remained, and the hotel still remained a hotel. However, there was a large hotel built a couple of blocks north that had all of the creature comforts we're used to now, meaning a bathroom in each room. And so the hotel itself went into some demise. At that particular point, a lot of the downtown area had some difficulty because of the crisis, the farm crisis, actually. And there were several banks that failed, not only the City National Bank. So Mason City was going through a real rough time. The hotel itself remained a hotel until the 70s. It was purchased and made into apartments. And then after a period of years, it turned into kind of a pigeon coop.
It was a hotel for pigeons.
It was in real need of maintenance and repair. The city understood that. There were several people from town had different ideas. There was one idea that came forth that they wanted to make it into low-income housing. That didn't fly. You know, some people wanted to do some condos. That didn't fly either. And then it just so happened that there was an organization called the Mason City Foundation that was working actually to do the Music Man Square, where Meredith Willson's museum and streetscape and such. They were doing a marvelous job of funding that, so they took on the hotel because the hotel was actually bought by the city. And the city turned it over to the Mason City Foundation saying, fix it, figure out a way to get it fixed. And they indeed did receive a Save America's Treasure grant for $500,000. And they did a lot of the necessary stabilization at that point. Mm-hmm. They fixed the roof. They did a lot of work in the basement, shoring up some of the walls and such. But after a period of time, the Mason City Foundation realized that it was not really within their mission to take on another project. And understanding that it was going to be a large project, they gave the deed back to the city, and that's when I was the mayor of Mason City at that particular point, and I asked for a group of citizens to put their heads together and figure out what they were going to do with the hotel. And so with the help of one individual and the Mason City Chamber of Commerce, we put together the first meeting, thinking that we would have maybe 10 or 15 people there. The room was full. There had to have been 70.
Standing room only.
There had to have been 70 people there that were interested in seeing something happen. I think that's when the heart of Right on the Park started to beat.
The park and renovations at a certain point turned into a local treasure hunt.
We were very lucky in a lot of respects. The chancellery windows that go around the bank in our what we call the ballroom, which was originally the bank building, was found as a fence over in Clear Lake. And
the Clear Story grills.
Grills. The grills that go on outside of the windows. And they donated those back to us. The skylight glass in the skylight room was actually found in Dr. Bob McCoy's house, and he and his wife Bonnie donated that to the Frank Lloyd Wright Building Conservancy, and then the Conservancy in turn donated it back to us when the building was complete. And it is absolutely breathtaking when you're standing underneath 25 of these beautiful art glass skylight.
Yeah, and it was just serendipity. Bob and Bonnie lived in their home in Rockcrest, Rock Glen, a Blythe home, and in their sun porch, they knew that there was something above the ceiling, but they didn't know what it was until Jonathan Lippman, who was an architect from Fairfield, Iowa, was in Mason City consulting on the hotel. And Jonathan said, "You know, Bob, I think there's something very, very special." Well, it turned out to be the skylight. Amazing, simply amazing. And we were fortunate that in Clear Lake, John Larson, who is a glass artisan, restored all of the windows and the skylight, everything. Just simply amazing.
Ann McGregor, the retired Wright on the Park executive director, along with the current Wright on the Park finance director and former mayor of Mason City, Gene Marinos. Martha Huntington, Wright on the Park project architect, had spoken to Iowa Public Radio about the Wright on the Park project in 2006. To hear more segments from Martha's interview and also more details from Ann and Gene about their historic hotel renovation project, please go to the drop-down classical menu and click on the Iowa Art Showcase link on our website at iowapublicradio.org. To make Park Inn, Boutique Hotel, or Evening 1910 Grill reservations, go to historicparkinn.com. To get more details about Park Inn Hotel tours and becoming a sustaining member of one of America's most valuable architectural treasures, go to rideonthepark.org. To find out more about the Stockman House, Music Man Square, the McNider Art Museum, and Clear Lake Surf Ballroom, go to visitmasoncityiowa.com. On June 10th through the 14th, Stebbins Children's Theater is presenting Still Life with Iris. The McNider Art Festival is going to be held on June 13th. Mason City's municipal band concerts are presented on Thursday nights in June and early July. And tonight, Wright's Cedar Rock House, located outside of Quasqueton, is hosting their annual Strawberry Moon fundraiser. Cedar Rock is also offering summer house tours. For more details, go to friendsofcedarrock.org. Just ahead, you'll find out about Marimba Mania. You'll enjoy downtown Des Moines as it embraces string quartet serenades. You'll hear about the Des Moines Metro Opera as it prepares for another fantastic season. And we'll learn about the North American Review's upcoming Bicentennial Conference. You're listening to Iowa Public Radio's Iowa Art Showcase.
It is, I think, the best kept secret in Iowa. It's this nationally and culturally significant literary institution, and it's been here at the University of Northern Iowa since 1968. Before that, it was at Cornell College in 1964. It was brought here by the poet Robert Dana. We're about to celebrate our bicentennial, so you can do the math. It was founded in 1815 in Boston. In 1878, it was moved to New York. So it moved from what you can consider the cultural intellectual center from Boston to the commercial center of New York, and now to the literal center of the country in Iowa. And it's changed from one city to the next. You can think of it as being in, you know, in different phases. Right now we're affiliated with the university, and so we find our home in that academic world of creative writing.
The University of Northern Iowa's Associate Professor of English and the North American Review Associate Editor, Dr. Jeremy Schraffenberger. Jeremy, who is serving as the North American Review's Conference Director, is talking about the longest-running literary magazine's Bicentennial Creative Writing and Literature Conference, being held next Thursday through Saturday on the UNI campus and at the Hearst Center for the Arts.
Well, what we want is to introduce the North American Review to those who don't know that it's here as a culturally significant institution that they can also be involved in. We've had plenty of people actually volunteer for us, read submissions, and help in the editorial process over the years. And so we want to make sure people know that it's here, and we also want to keep it vital. We want to make sure that it is not in this small elite literary coterie, that it's actually out in the world doing things. One of our mottos is we want to make art matter. And that's kind of a vague statement, but what does that mean? I think it means getting out in front of people and sharing the work that's being done out here. And I think that from the very early stages of the North American Review, through all the phases that it's been through, there's this assumption that language and literature matter, that they can actually have an effect in the world, that it's not just about pretty words, it's not just about beauty, that it also has a social responsibility. And so that's another mission of ours. I want people who are just being introduced to the North American Review to know that too, that we're interested in our place in the public world.
While many writers know that the nationally respected North American Review is based in Cedar Falls, many Iowans don't. Over its 200-year history, the quarterly publication boasts an impressive lineup of contributors.
Well, it's important simply because of the prestigious names of writers who've appeared in the pages over the years. We've published the writing of at least 11 presidents, for instance, 14 poet laureates, including the current poet laureate, Charles Wright, countless Pulitzer Prize winners and National Book Award winners. It's significant because of the writers who we've published, for one, but I think you can make this argument pretty persuasively, that you can read the history of America by reading the pages of the North American Review. And I find it really interesting because this bicentennial is asking us to look back at the pages of the North American Review, not simply to celebrate, I think that's part of it, to celebrate, to praise, to even wonder at a magazine that can last this long and still be vital, but also to understand something about where it came from and what it meant then and how it might relate to what we are now. So in 1815, it was founded in Boston, and it also marks the end of other significant milestones. For instance, that's the end of the War of 1812. And so the end of one significant cultural moment is the beginning of another, and I don't think that those are coincidental. You can think of that war as being sort of the last battle of the Revolutionary War, in fact. So my argument is that the NAR is the cultural and literary Declaration of Independence, whereas in 1776 we had the political Declaration of Independence. And those men who founded the North American Review were indeed interested in exactly that question of what it means to be American.
So just give us some of the names of some of the famous people who have been on the pages.
Well, my favorite writer is Walt Whitman. He's kind of my literary North Star. Wrote a number of essays in the North American Review in the last decade of his life. And in fact, we're publishing a book called The Great Sympathetic, Walt Whitman and the North American Review, which will be launched at our bicentennial celebration in June 11th through 13th. So his work was prominent. The work of Theodore Roosevelt, for instance, was prominent. Harriet Beecher Stowe was published in the pages. Ralph Waldo Emerson. It's interesting if you look back at those early issues, too, that you won't find many of the transcendentalists. You will find Ralph Waldo Emerson, but the transcendentalists looked at the North American Review as a slightly more conservative magazine. They were publishing in different venues that were more explicitly transcendentalist. If you read the list of writers in the North American Review, it almost reads as the table of contents to the Norton Anthology of American Literature.
You said that Robert Dana brought it to mm-hmm. Iowa. So give us a little of the progression after it's been here in our state.
Well, it was brought to Cornell College and was published there for 4 years. And in 1968, when we were becoming the University of Northern Iowa, it was thought that we wanted something to represent the university beyond our walls. We're now suddenly a university. What does that mean? We're a cultural institution. And so President Mocker at the time got approval to purchase the magazine for $10,000, which I think is a bargain for a cultural institution like this. And since then, it's been housed at the University of Northern Iowa. From 1968 until 2000, it was edited by Rob Lee Wilson, and he did a fantastic job of creating a reputation as a place where top-notch short fiction was published, as well as pieces about environmental concerns. So we had had and have a strong reputation of publishing environmental writing. It was also an early venue for creative nonfiction, which is a genre that, you know, is in ascendancy today.
And then in 2000, two new folks became editors.
Right, professors Vince Gotera and Grant Tracy. So Vince is a poet, Grant Tracy is a fiction writer, and they teamed up to co-edit the magazine. And they also did something I think extremely important. That is, they turned the magazine not just into a literary institution, but also a teaching laboratory. And over the past 15 years, it has served that purpose where hundreds and hundreds of students have come through here and learned what it takes to publish a magazine.
And you also have a North American Review artistic director. Tell us about him.
Right. Your listeners will know Gary Kelly. He's our art editor, and he selects the cover art, which is a very prominent cover art. In fact, the magazine has won awards for the cover art. And at the conference, actually, Gary Kelly is curating an exhibit of the art that has appeared on the covers over the years, and that will be at the Hearst Center through August.
Thursday afternoon at 1, the conference kicks off with Gary Kelly presenting a gallery talk about North American Review covers at the Hearst Center. Other unique offerings include an unveiling by archivist Dustin Witzman of his recently discovered James Hearst audio tapes, along with a panel discussion involving former Hearst students and a special NAR book launch.
We're launching this book, The Great Sympathetic. It's about Walt Whitman. And the NAR press in the 70s and 80s had a more active presence, published about 10 or 15 books. And this is the first book in many years. We're going to keep publishing books. So this is not just to celebrate the bicentennial, though it is that. This is the beginning of keeping the NAR press cranking. And so one of the projects is that we're going to have a National Poetry Book Prize that will probably be launched next summer. Our book of craft essays will be published probably in the spring of next year. And so this is an event where we're looking back. The bicentennial is an event where we look back, but we're also thinking about how we can see this as a new beginning also. And we want to publish as many different voices and as many different kinds of voices in our magazine as we possibly can. Publishing a book is another endeavor where we can focus on one person's voice and promote it. I think having a book feels a bit different from having a single piece appear in a magazine. And so we're really looking forward to it as a challenge, but we're also looking forward to it as a new way to interact with the literary world.
In addition to 3 days jam-packed with sessions on fiction, nonfiction, poetry, essays, and creative writing, highlighting next week's North American Review Conference will be a trio of amazing keynote speakers.
The fiction writer Stephen Schwartz is somebody who I would consider a master craftsman of short fiction. We've published his stories many times in the magazine, in fact. He's not only a great writer of fiction, he's also a great talker about fiction. So he can articulate things about the craft of fiction that might go unnoticed most of the time. And he's therefore also a master teacher. He'll be giving a talk about the craft of fiction. Memoirist Patricia Hampel, she's also a poet, is known for a lot of the meditative writing that she's done. She's written about her Catholic upbringing, for instance. And I think that will appeal to a lot of readers. And the poet Martina Spada is one of the most eloquent and powerful advocates for social justice that I've ever read, and so we're very pleased to have him reading.
Well, you have some amazing people coming in, and it's a marvelous opportunity to have authors of this caliber right here in the state and have access to them. So tell us, how can folks get more details and find out more information about this and get involved?
Well, people can go to the website, it's northamericanreview.org. They can also visit the Facebook page, facebook.com/northamericanreview. They can also email me if they like at schraffj@uni.edu. That's schraffj@uni.edu. And I'm happy to answer any questions. After each of the keynote readings, these authors will be available for signing books and small talk, too. There'll be a reception afterwards. So we're hoping that as many people as possible can come and hear them, but also interact with them.
The University of Northern Iowa's Associate Professor of English and the North American Review Associate Editor and NAR Conference Director, Dr. Jeremy Schraffenberger. All North American Review Bicentennial Conference events are free and open to the public. Next Thursday through Saturday, Salisbury House in Des Moines will present their Shakespeare on the Lawn performances of Much Ado About Nothing. Chamberfest Dubuque kicks off tomorrow and continues through the 18th in Dubuque. Members of Chamberfest Dubuque will present a live Iowa Public Radio classical performance on Monday, June 15th around 1 p.m. The Five Seasons Chamber Music Festival runs from June 15th through the 20th at the Mount Mercy University in Cedar Rapids. And the Southeast Iowa Symphony Orchestra will present a symphonic blast on July 11th in Burlington. Don't go away. Summertime String Quartet performances celebrate 15 successful years in Des Moines. The music of Puccini, Mozart, and Janacek grace this year's Des Moines Metro Opera lineup, and marimba mayhem reigns at ISU. You're listening to Iowa Public Radio's Iowa Arts Showcase.
My main goal was to be a rock and roll drum set player, which I think is kind of inherent in most percussionists' DNA, at least at the beginning of their training.
The Heartland Marimba Festival and Academy's Artistic Director, Dr. Matthew Colley. Matthew received his bachelor's degree at the University of North Texas and got his master's and doctorate at Northwestern University. Along the way, in addition to being a performer, he also became a composer, a clinician, and a modern dancer. The Marimba Festival and Academy starts on June 13th and runs through the 27th. Matthew fills us in on how the marimba became a popular instrument.
There was a movement by Claire Musser, who was a marimba player, and he worked for the J.C. Deegan Company, and they made instruments. They made large bells, you know, chimes and things like that. And they were based in the Chicagoland area. And Musser was a performer as well. He wrote marimba music, and this is like in the 1920s. He did a lot of performing solo and kind of in the vaudeville setting. But he broke away from Deegan and started his own company called Musser Marimbas. And so Musser did a lot for bringing the concert marimba to the world. And the closest marimba to what we know comes from Guatemala. And then before that, it originated in Africa. But the Guatemalan Central American marimba has a little bit of a different timbre with a buzz on the sound because of the way they fix a piece of skin to the bottom of the resonator. So there's a slight buzz. And that's traditional for their music. And so that instrument, through these people, Musser and Deegan and some other performers, came to the U.S., to North America, and they kind of redeveloped it, making it louder, taking off the buzz, turning the resonators into metal instead of gourd or wood, and kind of making it a sturdier instrument. So Musser started marimba orchestras of anywhere from 50 to 300 marimbas. It's amazing to have to think in the 1930s and 40s of that many marimbas on one stage. And he would tour the U.S. He did a couple European tours. And he had the marimba studio at Northwestern University. It was all female. And a lot of the performers that kind of started the movement of commissioning classical music pieces for marimba came out of that group of performers. Vida Chenoweth and Ruth Stuber Jean are two that I can think of. But yeah, at the time when Musser and Deegan were producing instruments, you could find marimbas and vibraphones and xylophones stocked in music stores to just go try and play and buy and take home. But now you don't see that. They're expensive instruments, and it's just not feasible for the companies to carry them in all the music stores to make a profit. That's sort of a short history of that, but I think that's kind of how it's got started.
tell us then about this Heartland Marimba Festival and Academy that you've started and how many years this has been going on.
So the Heartland Marimba Festival is in its second summer, and I had always had in mind for a while to begin a festival of this type, and I was also trying to finish up my doctorate, so I was kind of, you know, holding off and preparing for this plan. But it also gave me a chance to look into some ways to make it unique compared to other marimba festivals. And so an important part of it was involving the community and really getting out into the community. So we try to do a lot of our performances outside of the university setting, and also involving community members by starting a community marimba ensemble. And so that was one component, commissioning new music and having composers really deeply involved in the festival was another component. And of course, teaching upcoming performers and giving them a forum for learning about marimba and also a performance career in an intense setting with other professionals and guest artists. And then also providing some interesting opportunities for professionals as well to perform. So I really was kind of looking at it from four directions.
In Ames, you started the Merry Mallets.
Yes.
And they're going to be performing, and you're bringing in some great people. Tell us a little bit more about this festival.
Well, the Merry Mallets is a group of six community members in Ames. The one requirement was that they had to be able to read music, and then I would teach them the rest. So they'll be involved in performing in the festival, and they'll also perform in the All-Festival Marimba Orchestra, which will close the festival on June 27th. And we're hoping to have about 25 players in that marimba orchestra. And there's a guest percussion group from Madison called Clocks in Motion. They're fantastic musicians, and they're doing this percussion quartet thing full-time. And they'll be coming to do a lot of their own music and repertoire, and then we'll play some things together. I'll play a piece with them, and they'll play with the students, too. And we have two composers in residence. I'll be premiering two new solos for marimba that we commissioned. And so Andrew Arduzoya and Scott Price have written a new marimba solo that I'll be premiering. And we have a recording engineer on the faculty as well. And so a big part of the mission is offering professional quality recording time for the students. So the students who register for the academy play in an ensemble together, and then they get time to record with a professional recording engineer. That's some of the big points, and we're excited about the Marimba Orchestra, which will close the festival. We're really excited about touring in six cities in Iowa. So we hope that each year it'll get to grow.
Well, tell us a little bit about your tour. And I thought it was really neat that a couple of places you're going to be hooking up with the municipal bands, which I think is brilliant.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. This year I expanded it even more, and we're going to actually be the opening act for both the Ames Municipal Band and the Waterloo Municipal Band. And then we'll do a couple of short features like Flight of the Bumblebee with the band. And so that's a really fun experience for us, and it's a great audience. I feel really lucky that the conductors are willing to kind of let us present ourselves to this audience. And then we have a tour to Mason City, Dubuque, Des Moines, and Cedar Rapids, Waterloo, and Ames. It's a variety of venues. We'll play at art galleries, museums, the Des Moines Arts Center. So I tried to mix it up and go after a diverse audience throughout the state.
Now, most of the official part of the academy itself is going to be held on the Iowa State University campus, and you're going to have some concerts there as well. So tell us a bit about those.
Yes, we'll have some high school students and some college students, and we'll be at Iowa State for 6 days with a variety of classes and lectures. The composers give lectures, the recording engineer gives lectures. I do technique and musicality classes every day, and private lessons with all the guest artists, and then rehearsals and recording sessions. So the schedule is kind of a constantly moving thing for the students. So while we're kind of home based at Iowa State during that week, we'll do 4 concerts at Iowa State. We'll open the Academy with a concert to have the guest artist featured. And then we do a variety of chamber music concert, and then the final marimba orchestra concert. And my plan for the future is to move it around to different universities during the summer. And they'll always be the touring part. So I hope to continue to expand the touring part, and then we'll kind of have a different university each summer to host us for the Academy.
And some of these concerts are free, and some you're asking for donations. Tell us a little bit about how folks can get more information.
Sure. I guess technically all of the concerts are free. There's one fundraiser that we do require a fee for, but all the money, you know, it goes to supporting the artist, paying for operations expenses, and we're also currently trying to raise money to purchase a marimba so we can continue to do the community ensembles, and for the touring group, we need to have our own marimbas for that. So we'll continue to grow the arsenal of marimbas that are stored in my garage.
So how much does a marimba go for these days?
They can range anywhere from $3,000 to $17,000, depending on the different options that you choose for the wood of the frame. And all of the wood of the bars is rosewood from Central America. So that's kind of non-negotiable, but the other parts of it, like the frame wood and the resonator, color of the resonator, so all that could add extra expense. Be sure to visit us online at heartlandmarimbafestival.com. And I think the biggest way to support something like this is to come out to a concert, you know, try to get to something. And we're all around the state this year, so I think that's the biggest way you can support it, and also the biggest way to make sure that it will succeed and come back in the future, as if we have people showing up at the concerts.
The Heartland Marimba Festival and the Academy's Artistic Director, Dr. Matthew Colley. Their first Marimba Festival performance will be held next Saturday afternoon at 1:30 at the McNider Arts Festival in Mason City. The Cedar Valley Chamber Music Festival will present a few selections on Iowa Public Radio on July 16th at noon. Be sure to join us for our live broadcast. The Cedar Valley Chamber Music Festival will present performances July 17th through the 26th. Just ahead, the Des Moines Metro Opera celebrates their 43rd festival season, and the Bell and String Quartet revs up for the summer. This is the Iowa Art Showcase on Iowa Public Radio.
The heat and the wind is just part of the deal, but I personally am really excited about downtown Des Moines. I love living in the city. I like spending time downtown. But I'd say, you know, grab lunch and come listen, because it's really fun.
I agree wholeheartedly. I think that, especially as a classical musician, I know that non-musicians have this idea that classical music is kind of hoity-toity, or maybe a little upper crust.
Formal, stiff.
Yeah, too formal, too stiff, and I think that this quartet, the expression that we have, and also being outside and being much more laid back and less formal, might be a really wonderful stepping stone for people who might be a little anxious about attending a classical event.
Violinist Tracy Ingman Finkelstein and cellist George Work, members of the Bell and String Quartet in Des Moines. The ensemble was created when the Civic Music Association received a grant 15 years ago from the Iowa Foundation for Education, Environment, and the Arts, a charitable organization created by David Bellin. Each year, the group of 5 selects the music they will perform. George supplies some background on the quartet, and Tracy fills us in on how Bellin's 3 violinists play musical chairs over a season that includes 10 free summer concerts.
We have three violinists in the Belin Quartet, and depending on rep choices that we decide to play, some people are more comfortable with other pieces. It gives the three of us an option of rotating out, so we just throw out our rep ideas and decide who's going to play what.
I'd like to know a little bit of background about this quartet and how it came together.
Well, I'm actually the newest member, so my chronology is a little hazy, but I do know that the prominent attorney David Belin, who was on the Warren Commission and was also an avid amateur violinist, real lover of classical music, established a request in his will to create the quartet, and his specification was that it should be a group that performed noontime concerts in downtown Des Moines in the summer. So we've remained true to that vision. We also have an educational component. We do a certain amount of children's concerts out in the public schools during the year, and then just whatever other concerts arise. But that's how it came to be, and the Belin family continues to support us through their foundation. And I don't know if Lori was at the concert today, but she often comes to the first concert of the season, so it wouldn't surprise me at all.
Tell us a bit about the musicians that form the Belin String Quartet. And Tracy, why don't you start and tell us about all the violinists?
All right. Well, we have Julie Fox Henson, John Helmick, and myself. And this is my 11th summer. This is John's 12th summer, and I would think that this is probably Julie's 15th or 16th year, something like this. And we all play in the symphony. We all have private studios. John also plays in the Metro Opera.
Julie went to University of Colorado for undergraduate, and I think she was at UW-Milwaukee for one of her graduate degrees. John went to Eastman for undergraduate. And Tracy,
and graduate also, I think.
Did he? Okay. Tracy, I'll let you speak for yourself.
So I did my undergraduate at Northwestern, my master's at Yale, and my doctorate back at Northwestern.
And Julie was a violinist with a professional string quartet before coming to Des Moines.
It's Montclair, I think.
Montclair.
Well, tell us about your violist.
That's Sherida Josephson, who is the principal violist of the Des Moines Symphony and also has a big private studio here in Des Moines.
Right. She got her master's and her doctorate at the University of Iowa. And tell us, George, about your background.
I went to school at Eastman, did both my undergraduate and master's there, and then joined the faculty at Iowa State University and the then Ames Piano Quartet, which is the ensemble in residence, or was for very many years. We still have a piano quartet in residence. The name has changed. We're now the Amara Piano Quartet. That's what I do other than Belin. And I also play in the symphony.
And going back to David Belin's vision, as a downtown Des Moines office worker, he had this idea that the people in the big office buildings would come and grab a sandwich or whatever from a food truck and enjoy the summer and the start to the weekend by having a free quartet concert on Friday afternoon. And here in Des Moines, there actually is much more cultural activity going around than I think people realize. And it's a really great way to start off your weekend.
Violinist Tracy Engman Finkelstein and cellist George Work, members of the Belin String Quartet. The Belin Quartet has two June concerts left on the downtown library lawn starting at 12:15 p.m. On June 26th, the quartet will perform at the Des Moines Arts Festival in the Jazz and Wine Pavilion at 12:30 p.m. In July, the ensemble heads to Cowles Commons starting at 12:15 p.m. Their first July performance on the 10th will feature all five Belin Quartet members performing the Brahms Quintet in F. Their summer season concludes on July 31st with a children's concert at the Downtown Library starting at 10:30 a.m. For more details, please see civicmusic.org and click on the Belin Quartet link at the top of the page. All across the state, municipal and community band programs are in full swing. On July 1st, the 34th Army Concert Band of the Iowa National Guard will perform at the Fairfield Arts and Convention Center. On July 2nd, the Dubuque Chorale will perform at Eagle Point Park. Also on July 2nd, the Des Moines Symphony will present their annual free Yankee Doodle Pops concert on the West Terrace of the Iowa State Capitol in Des Moines. And the Iowa City Jazz Festival runs from July 2nd through the 4th in downtown Iowa City. Just ahead, over 150 singers flock to Indianola. This is the Iowa Arts Showcase on Iowa Public Radio. The Des Moines Metro Opera recently was bestowed with the 2015 Encore Award by Bravo Greater Des Moines. Their summer season has already started with their staging connections. Once again, the Blank Performing Arts Center will be the site of this year's three main stage productions. Artistic director Michael Eagle fills us in on this season's performances.
These are three wonderful operas in our main stage festival season, and I love how they work together in combination. We're talking about two of our major composers, Mozart and Puccini, but kind of exotic projects of theirs. We have Mozart's The Abduction from the Seraglio set in Turkey from 1782, which is a little bit of an off-the-beaten-track youthful masterpiece of Mozart's wonderful music, colorful costumes, great visuals. And then we have Puccini, who, of course, we know, having written Tosca, La Bohème, Madame Butterfly, these fantastic staples of the operatic repertory, but again, in an off-the-beaten place and location for him. We have The Girl of the Golden West, which is an operatic western. When the Metropolitan Opera was new in 1910, they asked him for an opera. They wanted a new piece, and who better to turn to in 1910 than Giacomo Puccini, the reigning living opera composer of the time. And they said, would you write us an opera for the Metropolitan Opera? And he said, absolutely, but I want it to be a western. I want it to be an American opera set in the California Gold Rush time period. And then there's Yennefer, first opera in Czech, one of the great masterpieces of Czech operatic literature. All three together, I think, make one of the most colorful and dynamic and richly contrasting tapestries of titles that we've ever put together.
Tell us about some of the stars that will be performing.
I'm very excited about this cast for The Abduction from the Seraglio, maybe more so than anything I've ever put together. And I think we've really hit the nail on the head with this opera. It's notoriously difficult to sing. The role of Constanze is one of the most difficult and unusual that has ever been written because the demands for it require agility and long-sustained singing and low and high and all over the place. And I found that person in Amanda Woodbury, who was second prize winner of Placido Domingo's international competition Operalia. And then Ben Bliss is our Mozart tenor Belmonte. I think that being a Mozart tenor is one of the hardest things and the most undersung voice types. And I say that because I think the music that Mozart writes for tenor is notoriously difficult, and yet it's not like the romantic stuff that Puccini writes where they sail up to the high sea and they get the big money note at the end and everyone applauds. These are guys that have to walk the tightrope and sing beautifully and sing in the hardest part of the voice, which is the upper middle. And we've got a guy, I heard him a year and a half ago, named Benjamin Bliss, and I was thrilled to get him here, and then I found out, you know, a year later, he's going to be doing the same role at the Metropolitan Opera, which I guess is a ringing endorsement of our selection. And then in the spoken role of the Pasha, which is a curious role that Mozart wrote of the Sultan of the Turkish Empire, who kidnaps Constanze, trying to convince him to marry him. Mozart wrote this for spoken voice. We have David Adam Moore, who sang the leading role in Dead Man Walking last year, to come back and do this particular part. What a luxury feat of casting that was.
And also Jonathan, who was here earlier this year for the Cedar Rapids Opera Theater.
Right, Jonathan Blaylock. I heard him sing Don Ottavio in Cedar Rapids. He's a great singer and wonderful artist. We're thrilled to have him here singing Pedrillo. And then Matt Bowler is Osmin. Osmin is the overseer of the seraglio. The seraglio means the harem. And he's sort of the ogre that oversees the harem. And that's also a notoriously difficult role in this opera because it's one of the lowest roles ever written. Osmin has sustained low D's, and so it's really the province of the deepest of bass voices.
And this Girl of the Golden West, you've got a soprano that not only packs a gun but rides a horse. You really did well on this one, Michael.
Thank you. Thank you. We have a great cast. Minnie is the title role in The Girl of the Golden West. And as I mentioned, this is a Western set in the exotic location for Puccini as an Italian composer of setting it in California. It's probably the only opera where you can say that there are phrases like whiskey per tutti and addio mio California. And the crucial scene is decided by una partita a poker. So you get this mixture of Italian and Western slang that's just kind of fun. But Minnie is the Girl of the Golden West. She's the lone female in a cast made up of entirely of men. Puccini wrote this opera for what we today might call a dramatic Wagnerian soprano. In fact, many people call it the Italian Brunhilde, making reference to the famous Ring Cycle of Richard Wagner, that this is Puccini's Brunhilde. So it requires a dramatic voice that can sing over a dense and thick orchestration and can be both feminine when she needs to be, as she serves as the mother, the surrogate mother for all of the miners and the gold rush, and then at the same time when the sheriff who's chasing her outlaw bandit lover comes to interfere, she takes her gun and her fate firmly in hand and takes charge of her destiny and rides off on a horse with her man. The sort of treatment of the leading female characters who either do themselves in or fling themselves off of buildings or die of consumption. This lady is a very different sort of character for Puccini.
And tell us about the two male leads.
Jonathan Burton is a Puccini tenor whom I've heard much about and think that he's just one of a lost tradition of great Puccini dramatic tenors. And when I heard him, I discovered that to be the case. And I think audiences will enjoy his singing very much. And then Christopher Ermiter, bass baritone with a lot of sinister and snarl to the sound, will make his debut here as the Sheriff Jack Rance.
And I don't know if we mentioned who will be singing the role of the dramatic soprano.
Her name is Alexandra Lobianco, and I remember I heard her a couple of years ago for the first time. Many colleagues had been talking about her, so I scheduled her for an audition in New York, and it was the same year we were doing Electra. And I'd already cast all the roles in that, and I thought, well, that's too bad. I don't know what I've got coming up that I'd be able to use her for, but I'd really like to use her. And then suddenly, 3 or 4 years later, the stars aligned and had the right opportunity and checked in with her and engaged her for this role.
Well, speaking about the stars aligning, tell us about this Janáček opera.
Oh, my goodness. This is a very special experience for us to be doing our first opera. Leos Janáček, I think his operas are amongst the most powerful, accessible, and distinctive ever written. Yennefer was his first opera. That's the one we're doing this summer in 1904. And immediately he found his own personal style, which is very terse, yet lyrical, and characterized with full and colorful orchestration with extraordinary rhythmic bite that can be recognized in every bar that he wrote. He's a wonderful composer, a Moravian composer from the early part of the 20th century. He worked as a teacher in Brno, where most of his operas were premiered. And it's interesting that the capital in Prague, in Czechoslovakia at the time, that the musical elite in that society remained kind of cool and indifferent towards Janáček. They wouldn't allow him to be placed in that time period alongside the beloved Dvorak and Smetana, who were the heroes of the day. Now I think the international music community has recognized that this is an extraordinary, distinct and unique composer and have given him his rightful place as, I think, one of the true originals of 20th century music. Wonderful, wonderful composer. And this opera, Yennefer, we have a stunning cast lined up for it.
And you're bringing Sarah Gartland back.
Yeah, this is a beautiful story, kind of a harrowing story through most of it, but it ends happily. As a matter of fact, this is a 3-opera season where we have all happy endings. I don't know that that's ever happened before. It doesn't happen very often. But it's a story about Yennefer, who is unfortunately expecting a child out of wedlock, and her stepmother. Actually, the title of the original play was Her Stepdaughter. Yennefer is the stepdaughter, and the her refers to the Kostelnichka, which is a title of a sort of an elder of the church. It was a position of moral authority in the community in Moravia at the time. Kostelnichka has to deal with the fact that Yennefer is pregnant and can't get the man who is the father of the child to wed her, and so she locks Yennefer away for the winter where she can have the child, and then when the child is in her arms, she's forced to come up with a way to deal with that, to save the family name and to save the child and to save Yennefer herself from outcast. And she resorts to some pretty difficult decisions and some difficult actions. But in the end, all is forgiven and ends with a very uplifting and powerful message. It's an opera that requires three generations of women, and boy, do we have stars for this one. Sarah Gartland, who triumphed a few years ago as Juliet in Romeo and Juliet, is taking on the title role. And then in the middle generation, the Kostelnichka, we have the legendary Brenda Harris with us, who's become a major audience favorite to take on this role. And then in the elder generation, the grandmother Borodyovka, we have the legendary figure of opera, Joyce Castle, who brings audience members with her from all over the United States who are devotees of this major figure in American opera. So we're excited about that. It's a stellar cast to meet the challenges of this very unique piece.
So let's hear what you have happening in June with your staging connections and your second stages.
The one that will be happening this summer is called Rappaccini's Daughter. It's by Mexican composer Daniel Catan, who unfortunately had sort of an untimely death a few years back, just at the peak of his career. But he wrote this opera, Rappaccini's Daughter, for full orchestra, three-act opera, I believe, originally in San Diego in the early 80s. And then close to the time of his death, he had just revised it for a chamber type of performance. So we will be performing the chamber production of Rappaccini's Daughter outdoors on July 9th and 12th at the newly remodeled Greater Des Moines Botanical Garden. This will be our first performance sung in Spanish, and it will be a beautiful and interesting way to interact with the operatic genre in an unexpected location.
And you're bringing Zulimar back for this as well.
Yes, Zulimar Lopez Hernandez, who had great success with us as Norina in Don Pasquale, and David Adam Moore, who, as I mentioned, was here with us for Dead Man Walking, is singing the title role of Rappaccini. So it's a stunning cast to lead this fantastic production. And actually, we have a debut tenor named Mackenzie Whitney, who has been having great success at the Academy of Vocal Arts in Philadelphia, but comes from Iowa and was a student at UNI not all that long ago. If you want to come to any of those events, all information is available at our website, which is DesMoinesMetroOpera.org, or they can always call our box office, which is 515-961-6221 to secure tickets.
The Des Moines Metro Opera's Artistic Director, Michael Eagle. The Des Moines Metro Opera's main stage performances start on June 26th and continue through July 19th at the Blank Performing Arts Center on the Simpson College campus in Indianola. On July 9th and 12th, Rappaccini's Daughter will be presented at the Great Des Moines Botanical Garden. On June 18th through the 21st, the Cedar Rapids Opera Theater's Young Artists will present Man of La Mancha at the Bruce Moore Mansion in Cedar Rapids. They will also present selections from the show on IPR Classical over the noon hour this coming Tuesday, June 9th. Please join us. The University of Iowa Opera will perform Gilbert and Sullivan's The Gondoliers on July 9th through the 12th at the Coralville Center for the Performing Arts. And the Texas Tenors will make a concert appearance at UNI's Gallagher Blue Dorn on July 15th. Today's IWARD Showcase June and July broadcast is a production of Iowa Public Radio. Program thanks for this show goes to Ann McGregor, Gene Marinos, Jeremy Schraffenberger, Matthew Colley, Tracy Engman Finkelstein, George Work, and Michael Eagle. Production thanks goes to Iowa Public Radio's Tony Daner and John Pemble. Thanks for this show also goes to IPR's Jason Burns and Garrett Van Leeuwen, and music director Al Scherz. Program research was provided by Nick Carlo. I'm Jacqueline Hallbloom. Thanks for joining us. For more information on Iowa Public Radio's programming schedule and Iowa Public Radio's Iowa Arts Showcase, please visit our website at iowapublicradio.org.